July 9, 2022, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Well, like, say, for example, like you said, 14 years ago, 44 was when you first started playing.
Yeah.
Well, when did you have your first professional gig with anybody?
Well, I usually call my first professional job was a band from Indianapolis, led by Joe Webb. This was in 47. Big Maybell was in this band, you know, Big Maybell. I don't know what the heck we were, rhythm and blues or everything. I don't know what that meant. Anyway, that band and King Kolax, you heard of Kolax, eh? Trumpets. And Eddie Vincent. Dizzy. Earl Bostic. Gay Cross. He's from Cleveland. He had a little band. He used to be with Lil Jordan one time in his band. He had a little band that was patterned after Lil's band. He sang and played something like Lil. And Daisy Me and the Hepcats. Johnny Hodges.
You did work with Hodges?
Yeah.
When was this?
In 1953.
For how long?
Six, 7 months, I think.
Really? Who else was in the band?
Well, we had Richard Powell on piano, and Lawrence Brown, Emmett Berry, Edward Trubley, who was. And a guy named Jimmy Johnson on drums. And bass player, I forgot his name.
Watt from Pedro Show, happy Saturday. Started off with John Coltrane talking to August Blum in 1958 about his first gigs. Then we had Chip Kimmon with Let's Go, Dark Shark. And that's from his new album, The Great Confrontation. And I am very fortunate enough to have with me, what are you talking to? Are you talking to me from the desert, Chip?
No, sir. I'm talking to you from Burbank, California.
Okay. Because you got two pads now, right?
Well, actually three. We still have the original Homestead in Carlsbad.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's down south.
Yeah, you bet. And then, we bought 5 acres of sand and horny toes out in the desert. Out in Landers, out in there near.
Landers by Kim White.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We're 10 acres away from Kim White. We can see her house from our, we have one Joshua tree on our 5 acres. Of course, we named it Joshua because the name wasn't taken. And, it's, it's a fabulous place to be. But my home, where I raise my kids and live with my wife, is here in Burbank.
Right. east part of the valley. Now, let's please bring your earliest musical recollection.
Earliest musical recollection would have to be, the very earliest would be driving to the beach in North Carolina when I was, probably about 8 years old, and hearing White Lightning come on the radio by George Jones, and we just, all of us kids just started cracking up. We thought it was the funniest thing we'd ever heard, especially when George goes, White Lightning. and little did I know that'd become a signature tune, you know. And mine and Tony's. I mean, Tony was born to say, White Lightning. Among other things, of course. But it was right up his alley. That's probably my earliest musical recollection.
Okay. And in the pad that you grew up there, was there musical instruments?
No. Our house wasn't particularly musical, except for my older brother Charles, who is older than Tony and I, and he was just the right age to be buying all the English Invasion records. And so his room, of course, it was plastered with posters of the Stones and the Beatles and the Kinks and all of that. And I was still a little bit too young, like, you know, 67, I was 10. So at 64, I was 7 years old. So I was just kind of absorbing the music, and it stuck. It all stuck in our brains. You know, I mean, it stuck so much that, of course, we got caught up in the whole thing, and we were begging our mom, we want Beatle boots.
Well, older brother Charles, now he didn't have a guitar or anything. He just had records.
That's correct. Yeah. Tony was the first one to play. He joined marching band.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about school, if you were in the choir, the marching band, or some shit.
Yeah, right. I wasn't. I was like hardcore pot smoking nerd, and Tony was in marching band. He played alto sax, and he was always really good right from the get go. He could, you know, he could read music. He could hear music. He could hear it and understand what was happening. Myself, when I finally got a guitar, I would like, hey, look, Tony, I learned the Day Tripper riff. And he'd go, well, that's great, but you left out like four notes. And the riff, I only had like seven. So.
But, you got more than half. What about the first record you bought with your own money?
That'd be Who's Next. Okay.
Pissing Stone.
Yeah, well, here's how that happened. Because my older brother Charles, I would hear him play records, and two of the records he played a lot around, I guess, 1972 or 70 when Who's Next came out, 71, whenever the hell it came out. He played Live at Leeds a lot, and he played the Woodstock album a lot that had, you know, Going Home by 10 Years After.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a little kid, that sort of solo playing kind of impressed me. So when I finally got some money to go buy a record, I went to the mall in Carlsbad. I thought, okay, I'm going to start a record collection. And Who's Next and A Space and Time by 10 Years After had just come out at the same time. I was holding both records in my hand going, which one am I going to buy? Which one am I going to buy? Thank God I bought Who's Next.
But you didn't know anything on Who's Next. Well, it was probably coming on the radio, right?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. All I knew is I liked Live at Leeds. So I thought that was a good record.
It is. Me and D. Boone dug the shit out of it. We like Sellout, too.
What was the first gig you saw? Go ahead.
The first gig you saw.
Easy. First gig I saw, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars at Long Beach in 1973.
Wow. Around that time, me and D. Boone's first gig, we saw T-Rex at the Long Beach Auditorium.
T-Rex? Wow.
Yeah, it was right around that time. We were 14 years old, right?
Now, the first gig I ever saw in a nightclub was New York Dolls in San Diego at the, like, Red Ball Saloon or something. And it was funny because that was in the days, okay? It was a couple years after I saw David Bowie. And then Tony and I started going to concerts just to look at bands' gear. You know, we didn't care who was playing. We would go, like, all these stadium shows and see stuff like Wishbone Ash and all that kind of stuff. Just to look at the gear, you know, get up front and go, wow, look at all that. And then, you know, we got into the Dolls, of course. And I remember going into the nightclub in San Diego and thinking, wait a minute, this room's really small. It's not a stadium. Wait a minute, they're right there. I'm sitting here. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like it was truly like a punk rock experience.
You know? Much different arena rock. I didn't even know about that situation until the movement, you know. All I knew was arena rock. And it's so much fucking different. It's hard to explain to people.
Yeah, it's I mean, it's funny because I don't really remember the show that much, the New York Doll show. I just remember the situation and it being so, like, it kind of brought me alive. It's that it kind of brought that whole kind of punk rock ethic of you can do it too. You sure can pick up a guitar. It kind of made that a reality. I never even heard the phrase. No one.
Speaking of which. You were talking about getting that guitar.
I could pick up a guitar a bit,
yeah, when did you pick up that guitar?
I picked up the guitar probably in, here's how it happened. Tony asked my father if he could buy him a bass. And my father said, well, you know, save your allowance. I'll take you to Camp Pendleton and where he could buy a Tysco bass at the PX. And of course, me being the bratty younger brother, I said, "Oh, if he's getting a bass, I want a guitar." So,
why do you think Tony asked for a bass?
What's that?
Why do you think Tony asked for a bass? Because most cats, especially in those days, would ask for a guitar.
Yeah, because Tony's perverse.
Oh, okay.
That's why. I mean, that's why he played alto sax and not trumpet. You know, the big glory.
Sure.
The big glory instrument in the marching band. You know, Tony's just always been one to go against the grain, and that hold him in good stead, myself as well.
He gets the Tesco from the PX, and then do you get your guitar from the PX?
I do, yeah. We got him at the same time. You know, my dad's being a bit of a soft touch. So we got him at the same time, and of course, Tony is off to the races. He's learning Punk Meets the Godfather, you know, on his Tysco. He's learning all this.
Graffiti, yeah.
Yeah, he could do that. He could, you know, he immediately, you know, learns the My Generation bass solo, all Paul McCartney stuff. I mean, like I said earlier, he has really good ears.
Yeah.
And I get the Tysco guitar, and I'm just banging on it, making noise.
Amplifier stuff?
An Alamo.
Okay.
Yeah, a little Alamo amp, which
Tony?
Have. And it's really one of the best amplifiers ever.
What amp did Tony get?
I think we just got that. We got one little Alamo amp. It has three inputs.
Okay, yeah, like the urinals, right? Why do you need two amps? It's got two inputs. Yeah.
Exactly. So it'll work. Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Mike, I didn't learn not even one chord. I was just fascinated that sound came out. And then finally, of course, I had to, you know, being a brat kid and a Pete Townsend fan, I ended up just smashing it because it made a glorious sound when I smashed it.
Well, what kind was it?
It was just a little old Tysco guitar. Okay. I don't know the model at all.
Yeah, I don't know if they had names on it, but I remember those. They sold them at Thrifty's like for $10.
Yeah. I mean, there was really something else. And then I finally got after that, I got an acoustic guitar, which didn't sound as good just to bang on, so I had to learn some chords.
I want to play Golden Robot.
Sounds good. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
For Pedro Show, that chunk of music started off with Chip Kimmon, Golden Robot. Right. Then we had brand new from Bombas Prendon, A Wild Sheep Chase. Brand new Lampredonto. And Mark Stewart from the pop group with Wasted, Lady Neptune, Apocalypse. And finally, The Great Confrontation, the title tune from his new album, Chip Kimmon. And to continue. Now, do you and Tony make a like a bedroom band? I'm talking about like after school. That graduated, but in the afternoon time, you know, bedroom band, yeah, garage band, basement band.
Well, actually, Tony was in, let me see, he started in bands first. He joined a Christian rock band, but he playing bass, but he got kicked out because he played too loud and he wouldn't turn down, and which is awesome. They're called Saved by Grace, and of course we call them Sprayed by Mace. And then, yes, and then he joined a local cover band called Summit, and he got kicked out because he wouldn't play Smoking in the Boys Room. He thought it was stupid. And then I remember I wanted to join Summit. Of course, I was a complete craft guitar player, but I wanted to join too. And Tony told me, I'll never be in a band with you.
Even though it was somebody else's band.
Yeah. And then after he got kicked out of that band, that's when he said, okay, you know, look, no one else in Carlsbad likes the same music that I like, but me, you know. So we formed a band together. And at first we played covers, you know, we played two songs, a New York Doll songs, a couple Bowie songs.
Was it a duet? Did you have a drummer, man?
We had several drummers. We sure did.
So it was like the Dills.
Shortly thereafter, that's what we called the band. We called the band the Dills. And we had a lead singer too.
Jeff, because Brendan Mullen had a picture of a four-piece Dills. that yeah. I saw up in his drawer in the Club Lingerie office.
Yeah, yeah. It was Jeff Scott who went on to form the Hitmakers, a San Diego band.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And he, so he was our singer, but he quit the band because I think I wrote, the first song I wrote was Tell Her I Love Her. And it's, you know, kind of a Buddy Holly ripoff.
Sure.
And, but he thought it was, I was like, which is really weird. So we were a cover band, but he thought I was selling out. So it's like, well, okay.
You guys are still teenagers, right?
Yeah. We're okay. Still, yeah, it's like we're, it's 1975. We're just getting out of high school and stuff.
11th grade or something. Yeah, and you're selling out, right?
Okay. No, I wish.
Okay, but did you, was there four-man deal gigs?
Yeah. In fact, our first punk rock gig was a four-man deals gig. We, when we did the Peter Case gig, we were four, at Gower Gulch, we were four-man, four piece.
Was Peter with the Nerves?
Yeah, with the Nerves.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Right.
And when we first went up to San Francisco, we went up as a four piece. And then all that,
the deals, well, Tony wants to make a band with you. Has the movement, have you heard about Ramones and shit?
Of course. We knew about the Ramones through Rock Scene magazine.
Oh, yeah, Rock Scene, right.
Yeah, and so we were reading about them, I think, since 75.
Of course, the Dolls, they had that Mercury Arts trip going, like, kind of residency.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah,
of the CBGB
yeah.
thing. Richard Hell told me that's where he got the idea of the CBGB thing. You have the gig at the same place all the time and people know where to go.
Oh, residencies are great. The Dills did a great one at the Art Institute in San Francisco. That was so much fun.
Yeah.
But we used to read about the Ramones and we knew they had to be great. We had no idea what they sounded like, but we knew they had to be great. And when the record first came out, it's funny because Tony and I, we sit down and listen to it and we put it on and listen first song, going, okay, that's cool. And the second song and the third song. And I'm going, wait a minute. You know, there's no solos and all kinds, you know, cause we had no idea what we were getting into.
Right.
Right. Alike, there's no solos.
Cause New York Dolls in a way, they got some Chuck Berry and yeah.
Yeah, but
Ramones, like, they make a big departure, yeah. Especially from arena rock. Yeah, no drum fills, no solos.
It was like from outer space. And I said to Tony, I said, I'm not really sure about this. And Tony looked at me and said, hey, and I guess I had paid for the album. And Tony said, take this record home, listen to it. And in 20, because he got it right away. And he said, in 24 hours, if you don't think this is the greatest record you've ever heard, I'll buy it from you. The next day, I picked up the phone, I called Tony and said, this is the greatest record I've ever heard.
Right, Tony.
Yeah, it took me a day to, you know.
Right. I'm curious, what was the first Dills song written?
Well, I guess it would be the first Dills As You Know It song ever written would have been I Hate the Rich.
And was that three-piece or four-piece?
Three-piece.
Okay. So the four-piece Dills didn't really write a lot of songs?
Not a lot. We wrote,
you wrote that song that made the singer leave.
Yeah, we wrote Tell Her I Love Her. And, other than that, not that much. I remember our drummer had written a song and he was like really into Russian stuff. And wrote the song and you know, I think he called it Sirius the Dog Star or something. It was like, doo 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 doo. You needed a slide rule to figure out what was going on.
Where was the first Dills gig?
As a three-piece?
No, as a four-piece, I'm curious. Then as a three-piece.
As a four-piece. I had booked the first was like at some, you know, a kegger party in Carlsbad.
Yeah.
But after that, I called every high school in North San Diego County and booked a lunchtime tour. I said, look, we'll set up on your basketball court. We'll set up outside. We'll set up anywhere. Just let us play. And I did. I booked about like five shows at high schools and, you know, to play during lunchtime. And of course, everyone hated it. But still,
that's a trip. That's innovator. Yeah.
Lots of fun. But the first three-piece Dills gig was, what was Up and Spoke.
Oh, you mean the movie? Okay, when you guys, it's not even a song, right? You're tuning up.
Yeah, the movie, the Cheech and Chong movie.
Yeah, the Cheech and Chong movie, but you guys ain't even playing a song. It's so fucked up.
I know, we played about half a song.
Yeah,
anyway.
Like in your tuning or something, it was like the weirdest fucking thing. And a lot of bands tried out for that, right?
Yeah, they were all there. They were all there. We heard about it because Peter Urban, he had heard Rodney on the radio for some reason. I don't know how he picked out our name. Maybe he remembered it from the Peter Case gig or something, the Nerves gig. But he said, oh, you know, the Cheech and Chong's filming a movie at the Roxy, and it'd be a great opportunity for bands like the Dills. So Peter Urban calls us up and said, Rodney just said the Dills should be in this movie. We hopped in our van. We drove up to L.A., and all the bands were all lined up getting ready to do their song. And right when we pulled up, the AD or whoever, he came out and said, okay, who's next? And we said, we are.
And so you didn't wait in any line. You just arrived, right?
Yeah. And, you know, of course, we get stink eye from everybody.
Yeah,
and
of course.
We say, get on stage and don't stop. Just play your song, don't stop, and then get off stage. And, of course, we stop because Andre,
drummer,
buddy Hate at the time, he had been playing drums for about a week and a half. So. He didn't know what was going on.
Okay. And so you had to stop when he was on the other side of the beat or something.
Yeah. Where are we in the song? You know, it's a minute and a half song. Where are we?
what tune were you doing?
You're Not Blank.
You're Not Blank. That's what I figured. Okay. Because it's kind of hard to tell, man, because I was looking for you guys in that movie.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's so many people, like, so we did that, and by the time the movie came out, we were fire-breathing commie punks. I mean, Class War had come out, you know, we were firmly the Dills. And I remember someone saying, hey, Chip, you're in the new Cheech and Chong movie. You're horrified. We were horrified. Pot smoke hippies, no!
Yeah. Be careful for what you wish for. Look, Chip, we're at the end of the July 9, 2022 edition of Why Peter Show. Special guest, Chip Kim. Hold tight for hour two. July 9, 2022. It's the second hour of the Why Peter Show.
Thank you. communicating with and channeling the dragon spirits. Gods of Arthur C. Spirits, they will watch over us for the times and adventures to come. The dragon spirits atop Arthur's seat.
After Pete Rocha. I said the same thing to him. He laughed, too.
Okay, yeah.
People, we started the second hour off with Chip Kimmon with My Predominantly White Family. Ben Salter out of Tasmania with Impulse. Kiwi Jr. out of Canada with Unspeakable Things. World is Run by Mass Persuasion by Ember Nahn and Michael Vega. Here's a title. This project's from England called Puppet Midnight. Communicating with and channeling the dragon spirits atop Arthur's seat.
Wow.
And finally, Chip Kimmon.
Hello.
Abolition of the concept of performance. Okay, so much drama in the Dills, right?
Oh, of course, yeah. It was all drama.
Right. All inside the band with the drummer, and then outside the band with all the other bands. And then Peter Urban, right, his own perspective on that dimension. And so that whole thing is like only in a couple years, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it was, it's time's compressed, you know, when you're talking about rock. It's because, I mean, you have first wave bands, you have second wave bands. I mean, you could even consider like X a second wave band.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah, because, you know, they weren't around when we did the Nerve Show.
And also, when things changed back then, it was right away. Right away,
yeah.
Something, the paradigm keeps shifting and shifting and shifting. It's not like now with this long plateau.
Yeah. Well, that was our reality we were living in, and that's the way we all felt. Everything was right away. Everything's now. We are the future. This is the future. We're going to push it forward, and everything else be damned. And I'll tell you what, man. You know this, Mike. When you're 20 years old, what you do. That's what you do.
Of course, it's all moment. It's all moment. No tomorrow. No yesterday. All moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Busted up. And Alondro gets a band together, and you and Tony help him out? Because, you know, a lot of people, they talk to me about Rank and File, and they think it's you guys' band. But you guys actually got in there to help him out, right? The Nuns.
Actually, no. What happened is Phil's broke up. Tony said, okay, you know, punk rock was it for me. I'm done with music. And he moved up to Portland to be a night clerk at a motel, which didn't work out too well. And I still wanted to play, so I called up Alejandro, who was living in New York City playing with Judy Nylon. And I called up, I said, hey, Al, you want to start a band? And he said, sure.
Oh, so it's your idea. Okay.
Yeah. He said, come on out to New York City.
Because Tony, when he came down to Pedro and was on the show, he said it was Alejandro's idea, and he came in to help out or something. Well, everybody's got that, what's it called, Rashomon moment.
Exactly, for all the different perspectives. So I should tell the
listeners, that's a Mr. Curazao movie from the 50s, and they even bring back the murdered husband's spirit to testify, and he's got his point of view, right?
That's such a terrific movie. I mean, but any Curazao movie is that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But I drove out there, and at the time,
to New York City? That's 2,800 miles.
I drove out in the I Hate the Richmobile, you know, our big red van.
Sure.
I should say something
about that to people, because those old days, those 70s punk, most of those bands in Hollywood didn't even have a van, people. I think they just wanted to be king of Hollywood. The Dills, you guys were like one of the only bands that was touring.
That's correct, because we had a van. So we drove, I mean, we played New York City, we played up in Canada a lot,
we did Pacific Northwest
all the time, went out to Austin a couple times and played, simply because we had a van. You know, the Avengers didn't have a van,
no.
We did.
Right.
Yeah,
and
then, so
you know who had a van, too, was the DOA guys, because they were touring early.
That's correct. We did a great tour with Pacific Northwest with DOA and the Dish Rags. And I'll never forget, we're loading out of Portland. And Chuck Biscuits puts all of his cymbals on top of the van while he's loading everything else in. And you forgot they were there and drove off. It was the best sound I ever heard in my life. The cymbals were flying off the van and flying down the street.
So you drive out to New York City to meet Alondra for this new project.
Yeah. And that's when we decided to play country music because we're perverse, you know. It's like, what can get up the punk's noses? What does everyone hate?
Right.
Country music. Great. Well, that's what we'll do. And so we started, you know, we started the band with that in mind. I wrote songs. I still wasn't writing songs with Alejandro. In fact, I've never written a song with Alejandro. I was still writing with Tony, and we were doing it through the mail. I would send him lyrics, and he would, like, say, well, this is a better verse, and this is a better chord change, that sort of thing. So it was
So that's how he got involved. Okay. He got involved that way, but via the U.S. mail. Was he the hotel clerk?
Yeah. Well, so that job wasn't working out too well for him. So we decided, our bass player at the time was Barry Scratchy Myers, who was the DJ for the Clash, and I booked a little tour for Rank and File. It was very little. It was like, you know, 4 shows in 4 weeks, something like that. But anyway, we ended up in Portland, and we picked up Tony. And
not
he was
Portland, Maine. But Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon, yeah. And he was going to join the band playing acoustic guitar, playing guitar, and keep Barry on bass. But then Barry thought, you know, with Tony in the band, this is going to be weird. So Barry left, and Tony stayed, and he played bass. And then we went back to New York City. Then we thought, well, we really want to play country music, so where should we live?
Moved to Austin. Moved to Bakersfield. Look, I want to play Italiano here, huh? Some Ciao Ragazzi.
Ciao Ragazzi. There you go.
Yeah. sanitaria, io ringrazio in maniera enorme, credo anche tutti voi stanno facendo il loro dovere in maniera straordinaria. Fatti qualche caso di medici che si sono dati, che si sono resi in malattia, ma sulle sanitarie adesso, e non ha fatto loro. Però credo che il fatto di logicamente siamo, ma è perché siamo intimi, io e lui siamo intimi, siamo quasi gemelli. Quindi, come potete notare, oggi abbiamo un bel dolce vita.
Verfrüht war die Hoffnung auf Frühling, in Prag, in Arabien, im Herbst. Im Frühling erwacht nicht die Völker, sie bleiben versehrt. Danton sprach dem Terror das Recht an. Berechtigt das Recht eine Farce. Der Mut wird uns klein, doch die Mäuler und Augen sind groß.
Thank you.
For Pedro, show that chunk of music. Start off Chip Kimmon off the new album Ciao Ragazzi, and then Kim Boone and Kester out of Berlin with their new album, and this tune is Groon is Due Revolution. Atmosphere after that, Circuit of Unconsciousness, and here's a little sentimental journey, Chip Kimmon off the new album, but San Francisco Fog 1977. What was it like to live in San Francisco in 1977?
It was probably the greatest place a young man could live if you had an artistic bent.
And it was Econo enough then too, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was easy to live there. It was a nice compact city and had such a great, alternative lifestyle, artistic, a feel to the city that you could tap into that and draw energy from that. And that's what we did. That song you just played, the San Francisco Fog 77, that was inspired by Will Shatter, and I used to walk around the city all the night.
One of the basemen for Flipper people.
Negative Trend. And we would,
before that, Negative Trend.
Uh-huh. And we would walk around the city, and we'd stay up all night. I won't bother to tell you how we did that, but we did. And we'd stay up all
magic
night.
Magic words.
Yeah. And we would theorize. We would talk about music and art and lifestyle and how to push things forward. And when I was putting together that song, San Francisco Fog, it just reminded me of just certain periods of just you know
that, there was a great band from up there that never really got to record much called the Sleepers.
Oh, Sleepers are great.
And Mickey, the singer man, was in a bunch of other people's bands playing drums or whatever. Maybe Negative Trend for a while, but I know he was in Crime for a little bit. There was all kinds of good stuff out of there, but No Mercy. Oh, I love that band. The drummer and the singer lady.
There were terrific bands up there.
What happened? Tell me about, okay, from New York City, you moved to Austin. What was Austin like back then?
Austin was terrific. It's a lot like it is now, but it wasn't as grown up. We went there to when we moved there, we were embraced by the punk rock community and the new wave community. And because we were in the Dills and the Nuns, and we used to practice like where the big boys practice.
And so
we immediately got a gig at Club Foot, which was their big new wave club.
Sure.
And yeah, we opened for Pylon.
Oh yeah, Georgia.
Yeah, and
they had this song called Dub. And it's one bass note. I love talking about econo. People say three chords. Fuck it. One bass note. Every time around, right? Onk.
Onk.
Onk. You know, I eat Dub for breakfast, a big lady. Yeah, I remember. And then what happened?
We did that show with Pylon. Yeah. And then after that, the guy who ran the club, because we play country music, he said, you know what? You're not invited back. They were very protective of their, for lack of a better term, their new wave scene. And to them, country music was still a bad word. It wasn't hip yet like it is now.
Oh, so there was no cowpunk word yet.
No.
Okay.
So we had no gig. So we found a real down and out honky tonk, and they gave us a gig every Sunday. We had to play 5 sets. And there's only like a handful of snuff queens and drunks in there. And then we found a gig at this place called the Alamo Lounge, where we played, acoustic shows. And, from that, we built up our audience with, college students and like the,
you never played the Continental Club?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. That's where Minutemen first played Austin.
Yeah, we played Continental. We played
Mark Pratt, Terry Pearson. Mark Pratt went up the what was it called? Liberty Lunch. A little later.
Yep. Yeah. Played Liberty Lunch. We played. Reconcile ended up playing every place there. We didn't get real accepted until we got signed to Slash, and then they went, "Oh, okay, you guys. Okay, country music. Okay, we'll listen."
and then you make the album. You tore it up, and what happened?
Oh yeah,
beat the band into the ground, or what happens?
Well, we were hitting it hard with Sundown.
Sure.
It was a very popular record, and I'll tell you what, I think we probably, it is a good record. It stands on its own, but Robert Hilburn from the LA Times, he gave it a top 10 on his list, and that's what really put it over. Because everyone else went, oh yeah, of course this is good, you know, and they listened, and it was good. It lived up to the hype. Really, really, really good record. We did really well with Rank and File until we kind of destroyed it ourselves by making that hard rock record, our third one.
But you know what? What I've gotten to the point, music is music, man. So why can't it be anything you want it to be?
Well, that's what we've always believed. And it's always worked for us. It just didn't work for us with that record. I mean, I think that song has some terrific.
X tried a hard rock record too, and it didn't work.
Yeah, it was a hard gig. So we went from playing every packed nightclub to every empty nightclub in the United States.
But we call those character builders.
Yes, they were.
You were busy building a lot of character.
Uh-huh. Yes, someone will say, hey, how many people are at your show? Remember, count yourself. Okay, 7, you know. I mean, we played shows where nobody came. Absolutely nobody came.
That's a lot of character. Or maybe the opening band. You're taking turns playing for each other.
You're so much fucking character.
Letting the sound man get a lot of prac in.
But that's what brought up. You know, I'll tell you, here's how it built character. is you would do your sound check, and they'd say stuff like the sound man or whoever, hey man, Bob Mold was here last night, he sold it out, it was just great. And then you go, oh, that's awesome. So then you go to your hotel, you go back to the show, you see the parking lot's completely empty.
Yeah.
But there's six people there who love you.
Yeah.
And you would put on your show just for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course, after that, they'd go, this town sucks, man. No, the town doesn't suck. No one just likes this. It's all good.
Yeah, and like you said, too, about timing, and people are fickle, and they get caught up in the scenes and clothes, and I wonder if it is about music. So sure, you did it yourself by making that third record.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where the band was at. So, you know, at least you were being honest with yourselves. Maybe you weren't pandering to whatever the fucking... Mom
well, wanted. We weren't, and it was definitely a reaction. We were like done with country music, and we thought, again, mine and Tony's perverse thing. We thought, well, what can get up the nose of people now? Because now the country music's accepted. Ah, hard rock.
Sure, just sure. Like that, look, we're at the end of the second hour. I got to cut you off a little bit here, Chip, and we'll continue on. But July 9, 2022, just Juan Peters, a special guest, Chip Kim, and Old Time Hour 3. July 9, 2022. It's the third hour of the Watford Pedro Show.
Mm-hmm.
Rock for Pedro show. Start third hour off with Round by Danny, Chip Kimmon. After that, Crane with Echo Rock Groove. Rubber O Cement with Your Malavision Guru Needs Ate My Asian Gurus. Fucking
wow.
Title. Yeah, and then Chip Kimmon with I Can Count to 19.
There you go.
Because everybody knows Tony. Right, the idea is you can't have two brothers in a punk band. So I'm going to change the last name so no one knows, right?
That's correct, yeah. He didn't want people to know we were brothers.
But you know what's bitching? At least he didn't make you change your name.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
Yeah, right.
But that was classic Tony. I've told this story before, but he's, this is Tony in a nutshell. We were rehearsing a song and I know I'm skipping ahead to Cowboy Nation, but we were rehearsing a song. And we finished the song. I thought I played it great. And I said, turned to Tony, said, Tony, what'd you think? And he said, Chip, that sounded really good, but next time, can you make it sound like music? Okay.
Okay. We got to get into the new record because we've got so much spiel here. Man, this is a departure from Dills. This is a departure. You know, well, maybe you're used to changing gears because you were doing this stuff 30, 40 years. You know, it's time to change. I want to play this style. I want to do this. So what came up with and this is just called Chip Kim, and it doesn't have an alter ego name.
No, Chip 18. No, but I've always wanted to do something different. I don't like retreads. I always like kind of pushing it forward.
Right.
And it's, I'm more into, I'm not so much into craft and commerce. I'm just more into like art and revolution and, in certain senses. So, for this record, and there's another thing. It's a lesson I learned from Alejandro, actually. He said, do what you do and do it well and leave everything else alone. Don't go where you don't belong. So it's like, I would never make a reggae record.
But you made a one-man band record.
Correct, but electronics.
Was that kind of, also electronics, but the idea of you not being with the band, that's kind of new, right?
Oh, it's totally new. I collaborated on side one. I collaborated with Stephen Lindsley.
Stephen Lindsley, he's a bass man. He played with Jim Carroll for a while, right?
That's correct. And he and we worked together. And then COVID happened, so he couldn't. I had this little studio set up in my house, so he wasn't coming over anymore. So I just did the record all by myself. But I just wanted to do something different. I wanted to do something radical. I wanted to do something I hadn't done before. And I wanted to do something as in your face as I Hate the Rich, as in your face as Blackbird, as in your face as, Cowboy Nation.
Yeah.
Something that is just undeniably, in your face.
Now, I know the instrumentation you changed, but what about the way of writing songs? Was it different for you?
It was. I think they call it these days. They call it sound design or something like that. Because I'll tell you what. I don't know how to play keyboards. I don't know how to play synths, but I know how to make records. So I borrowed from Brian Keyhew. I borrowed who he does like synths for The Who and stuff like that. I don't know if you know him. He's really great.
Oh no, I've heard of him. I don't know him, but much.
Yeah, I was after I got my deal, I was going to go out and buy a Mini Moog and make my record on that. So Brian Keyhew has a studio, and I went to his studio because I didn't want to spend my money on like headphones and cords and those sorts of things. So I was going to borrow them from him, and I told him I was going to buy a Mini Moog, and he said, "Hey, I've got this Moog Musonics, which is a predecessor of the Mini Moog, and it's made in 1970. It's this big hulking, keyboard synthesizer thing." He said, "Just use this if you want." So I brought it home, plugged it in, turned it on, and went, "I can make a record off this."
Now, is there guitar on this record?
The only guitar you might be glad to hear about this is a bass and
You mean a bass guitar?
A baritone guitar.
A baritone, okay.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
people is like, it's tuned down like a bass, but they got still little strings, so you don't have the punch.
It's kind of in the middle. It's a down electro baritone. And those are the only guitars on the record. I did record a song for the album that had vocals on it, and everyone seemed to, you know, everyone loved it, but it was like one song with vocals, I'll just keep that one off the record. But I recorded the whole album, and I gave it to Larry Hardy at In the Red Records and said, Larry, I gave him everything I recorded. I said, you make an album out of this, you tear it down and put out the parts you want to put out. And he listened to it and he said, I want to put all of it out. So that's why it's a double record.
Wow. And you kind of were relating to this, that word. It sounds like something for a film soundtrack, but there, it's kind of a journey with a landscape going by the windshield, windows as you're driving.
You know, it really is. The album was recorded to be an album, not just a collection of songs, but an album that you put it on and you listen to it all the way through. And at the end of it, you go, well, that took me somewhere.
Right, right. Well, look, this is actually kind of a cover, right? Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
My cover, yeah.
We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Fever Show, last music for this edition. Chip Kittman started off with his version of Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And then we had Awa from Fujita. A lot of eyes there. And finally, Chip Kittman with Pop Becomes Art Becomes Pop. So, yeah, enlighten us to the cover.
Yeah. Oh, the cover. I figured it needed one more song to really end the record and end it on a high note. and so I recorded this piece of music. It's actually about 12 minutes long. And it was like what you hear, a circle being breaking. It was going, gah, 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 gah. And I'm going, what am I going to do? And I thought, you know what? I really like that Carter Family song, Will Circle Being Broken. But you know what? I think it's a bit long. It's 3 minutes and 7 seconds long. So I went and got that piece of music.
Yeah.
I went to the end, and then I went forward to 3 minutes and 6 seconds. I cut a second off the song, and boom, I had Will the Circle Be Unbroken. And that is my ultimate perverse statement of I mean, ever since, you know, I hate the rich, or I want a Tysco, you know, where this conversation started, you know, here I am 64 years old and I'm still putting that out. And it's funny. I have a friend in Austin, Texas, Monty Warden. He writes hit country songs, number one country songs. And I played them. I said, I want to play you my circle, my version of Will the Circle Be Unbroken. I listened to it. And he said, you know what? That is Will the Circle Be Unbroken. And will you produce my next gospel record?
Wow.
I said, yes, I will, sir.
Have you done producing?
You know, I haven't. That's the first time I've produced my own stuff, but that's I was ever asked to do something. So,
That's bitching. That's very kind of him. Yeah. The guy who writes big country hits. So he heard, and also going back around, music is music. The genre thing is bullshit.
It is. You're absolutely right. And music is not only is it what you play, but it is what you say it is. That's why the record has a bit of a Marcel Duchamp feel to it. That it's like, hey, here's a toilet, and I say it's art.
John Coltrane said you could play a shoestring if you're sincere enough.
Exactly. So I can put out that, I can put out Will the Circle Be a Broken, I'll say, that's country music.
Yeah.
And who's going to, that's what we do with Rank and File. We never called it country punk. We never called it cowpunk. We called it country music. Because that's what it was.
Yeah. And people aren't in charge of your fucking naming anyway. And you're not in charge of their naming. So at the end of the day, listen. Yeah, where can people find you on the internet?
They can. I'm on two of the socials.
Facebook. But there's no Chip Kidman website.
Nah, there's not.
Well, that's like having your own fanzine because you don't have a corporate guy in the middle. But a corporate telephone pole to staple up flyers, I can understand that.
That's exactly right. Well, I only go on it because I don't do a lot of social stuff on it. I go on it when I have a new record out. Like, so I want everyone to know about it because that's kind of the way people know about it.
No, like the gigs in the old days, right? You got to put the flyers up on the poles. What about when you get a record done, are you already thinking about making another one?
I am. And as a matter of fact, I just talked to Larry Hardy yesterday, and I said, you know, we asked him how it's going. He said, it's going terrific. You know, sales are really good. Everything's good. And I said, and I don't really have a contract with Indorette. I think that's how he does business. And so I mentioned the next record and, you know, seeing if he would bite. And he goes, Oh yeah. We're not doing one and done. Oh yeah, we're making another one. So instantly my mind started going, okay.
Yeah. Now when you get it done, will you come back on the show? And I can give you more time to spiel, because I could spiel with you for a lifetime and a half.
I think we could, and I think we have, my friend. I think we have. Of course, I'd love to be on involved with anything you do, Mike.
Okay. Big love, Brother Chip. People, it's been July 9th, 2022 edition. Watt Pedro shall keep you powder dry.